listening to the Central Station Podcast, where we bring you true stories of what life in the outback is really like and why many wouldn't live anywhere else. So pull up a stump, pop the billy on, or crack a cold one as we talk to the men and women who call some of the most remote parts of Australia home.
The time we spend with people and places doesn't determine the impact they can have on our lives. That is so very true for today's guest, Pip Bain. Although her family sold Mount Clare Station when she was just 8 years old, those 8 short years shaped Pip's life and love of the land. The same goes for her mother, who passed when Pip was just 18 years old. In this episode, Pip recalls memories of her time at Mount Clare and how she found her way back to the land. She also speaks candidly about losing her mother through suicide and how it influenced her views on mental health. For our long-term listeners, if any of this sounds familiar, that is because this episode was recorded and published in 2020 when the podcast was fairly new. Pip's story is so compelling that I thought it deserved a second run. Be sure to tune in next week for a follow-up episode with Pip. And of course, as this episode covers topics such as suicide and mental health, please refer to the show notes if you need links and numbers for any support services. If you take one thing away from this episode, it's that help is out there and please don't be afraid to ask for it.
Hi, my name's Pip Bain and I grew up on Mount Clare Station.
Whereabouts is Mount Clare, Pip?
Mount Clare is about 200 kilometres northwest of Meekatharra and it is officially in the Upper Gascoyne Shire, but right on the southern boundary.
Okay, and for anybody who hasn't had the pleasure of travelling through Western Australia, how would you describe Meekatharra or the Gascoyne region?
Well, when you've seen the rest of Australia, It's unique in its own way. It's, dry, rocky, shrubby. There's not a lot of grass left anymore. It's all old sheep country, so it got pretty flogged out in the older days.
Would you say it's, if you draw, you know that line that cuts NT and SA in half? If you kind of draw that across to like the middle of WA and then have a line going up and down the middle, is it somewhere or is it a little bit more on the eastern side, isn't it?
No, yeah.
If not, I mean, people have got Google Maps. They really should just Google Map this.
It's pretty much smack bang in the middle.
Of WA, okay. And so, yeah, it's like a semi-arid shrublands.
Yes, it's very arid. Oh, I don't even know. If you could just think of a desert with trees.
And lots of shrubs, clay pens, gravel.
We didn't have any clay pens. We were on the Gascoyne River.
Oh.
Or on part of Gascoyne, on the headlands, I should say. So, yeah, a lot of flat out country. In a good year, it was beautiful. There's just no other way to describe it. But in the dry, it is, it was bloody dry.
And so Mount Clare was a family station, is that right?
Yes.
Is it on your mum's side or your dad's side?
Dad's side. So it was founded by my great-grandfather, Eanie. He came out from Scotland when he was 8 and grew up in Katanning, fought in World War One, 10th Light Horse, wrote a book. Yeah, read up on it.
So he wrote a book?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Called The Ways of Life by Eanie Bain, and it's a really well-written sort of memoir on the life of he did a lot of droving and then, took on Woodland Station, which is right next door to Mount Clare. And, sort of one son took on Woodlands and the other son took on Mount Clare. And so my dad grew up on Mount Clare.
Okay, so it was your dad's dad, your granddad, that took on Mount Clare because Eanie was your great-granddad.
Yeah.
So. Wow, imagine coming all the way from Scotland to
Mount Clare.
Like, I mean, I've only been to the southern part of Scotland. Actually, no, I've driven up through the Highlands, and I'll be honest, I've been there once, but most of my experience in Scotland is watching Outlander. God knows if they actually even film in Scotland, who knows, but it is nothing like Meekatharra.
No, it sounds very, very different, but they were a different breed back then. They were tough.
So robust and adaptable.
Yeah, like, you had to. You didn't get a choice. So my grandfather, Alan Bain, for those who were wondering, he was a bit of a pioneer himself, did a lot of droving as a kid, and he was one of the first people to introduce grey Brahmins to the Gascoyne.
Really?
Yep. He's got a fair bit of history up here in Broome too. He was one of the he was a manager of Anna Plains back in the day.
Wow. So, yeah. I see where the grey Brahmins come from.
Yeah,
then.
Yes, yep. So he was definitely broadened his horizons. He we had really good friends in America, so knew all about the genetics and stuff happening in the States. Yeah. So then my dad grew up on Mount Clair and met my mum in 1975. She came out to be a governess, but long story short, my grandfather stole her off another station. Dad needed a cook because the one he had was not doing so well. And yeah, so grandpa and mum flew up to Yinnetharra Station, where my dad was managing at the time. And the, I don't know. That's where it all is. Yeah, the rest is history.
How did he actually steal her, though?
So she was meant to go to Meabury Station as a governess, and I'm not sure how carved in the stone that was, but Grandpa and some of the employment agencies were good mates, and Grandpa said that he needed a good, reliable woman. And they said, well, we've got a ex-nurse from New South Wales, Newcastle. If you want her, you can have her. So she got auctioned off to the highest bidder.
So you kind of got a 3-for-1. You got a nurse, you got a cook, and then a future daughter-in-law.
Yes, he did.
It's pretty thrifty shopping.
Grandpa knew good quality when he saw it.
Yeah. Oh, it's all about the genetics, whether it's cattle or human.
Pretty much.
Got to keep those breeding programs in line.
Yep, and if you've met a Bain, we're all tall and blonde. So my mother was neither of those, but anyway.
Now, what was it like growing up on a station in the – so do you call it – so Gascoyne – I guess Gascoyne different to Midwest.
Yeah.
If we want to get particular, because we don't want to offend anybody who lives in the Midwest or the Gascoyne.
Yes. Yeah.
It's like telling somebody from the Kimberley that they're in the Pilbara.
Yes.
Just don't do it.
Yeah. It's a bit like – yeah, I mean, if you really want to get local, you don't call someone from the Murchison from the Gascoyne, vice versa, or even Meekatharra Shire. Good Lord knows what happened.
So for the record going forward, where are we saying that you're that?
I grew up in the Gascoyne.
Gascoyne, okay. Now, what was it like growing up on a station out there? Tell me what it was like. I suppose you've mentioned a little bit of the country, but what it was like in terms of just a station, because they're all so different. What kind of made up Mount Clair?
A river, a gold mine, a lot of grazing country, a lot of flat out plains. I mean, it was 300,000 hectares. So the crew did a lot of camping out. And from memory, there was about 3 or 4 sets of yards. And yeah, I mean, as a kid, I don't actually remember that much of the property, but I do remember, you know, things like going for, it sounds nostalgic, but going for picnics up in the rocks and finding Aboriginal art, going up to what we called the gold mine, and yeah, we'd find fool's gold. There was all sorts of old shafts and cool old stuff up there. Silly things like going down, we had a creek really close to the homestead, and we'd go down there, my sister and I, and yeah, make cubby houses, and we used to go down looking for bush tucker and stuff like that, and my sister would always have to pull out a pack of the sayos from her backpack because we never found anything.
What specifically were you looking for?
Cogglers.
What's that?
I guess they're kind of like a bush pear in a way.
Okay.
If you get them at the right time, you can eat them whole. But usually by the time we found them, you had to sort of peel them. And yeah, they're pretty tough and awful. I think I'd rather a packet of sayos and bush potatoes and stuff. We had a lot of Indigenous stockmen in the camp. And my sister, being 10 years older than me, they would teach her what to look for. And, we'd go on these big adventures with our horses and our backpacks and try to, starve ourselves to death.
Until you had no choice but to rip into those sayers.
Oh, yeah, those sayers are lifesavers.
They would have been, especially if they had the little bits of salt on them. Like, that's the most satisfying part of the whole, cracker.
Yeah, if she really thought ahead, she'd bring out sliced cheese.
Oh, yeah. Now, Mount Clair, I'm trying to build a bit of a picture, also, not just for the listeners, but for myself. A lot of the stories that we've had on our website centre around really northern properties, which are quite different to the Gascoyne. Gascoyne doesn't have a defined wet and dry season, would you say? You can receive winter rainfall.
Yep.
Like we said before, it's semi-arid, historically quite degraded from sheep days. It's old sheep country.
Yeah.
So how many, do you remember like sort of how many cattle you ran or how mustering worked there?
Mustering went for to me it seemed like it went all year. We always seemed to have people there. From Mary, we always did two rounds. And I want to say that each round maybe went for 6 weeks.
Yeah.
So probably not much different to how things work now in the Gascoyne. That's probably on average most places muster for about 6 weeks. They'll do two rounds. Sometimes they'll do a first round, which will just be like a little half round, and then the second round will be the big show. But, yeah, we have crews of up to 8 blokes, or horses and buggies. Probably one of my favourite memories from growing up was Mum, we had this little Suzuki that we called the Butterbox. So it was all closed in. It was very safe, I promise. And Mum would lay a mattress in the back and she'd throw me in the back with a bag of Barbie dolls and a bit of Lego, and she'd go out mustering, and the Barbie dolls and the Lego would end up flying out the windows. So I'd end up playing with all the sticks and leaves that came into the buggy. And, camping out. We had a windmill called Timara that had a little shack and a old pump mill. And, yeah, it was just nothing to go down there and camp out with the boys for a couple of nights and help in the yards. My whole family was really involved in the property. There was no such thing as the women stay at home. Mum was just as involved as anyone else, and I was tag girl. So I'd load the tag gun for the boys. So.
What else do you remember about your time at Mount Clare? Because you didn't stay there for a long time.
No, we moved to the Midwest in about 98, 99. So I was only there till I was about 7 or 8. But funny enough, it was long enough to really have that outback way of life really set in stone. I've forever loved stations and working on them. And there's something about when you drive into a homestead, there's this feeling of coming home for me. And I don't think it matters what homestead I drive into. And I've worked on a lot of places in the Gascoyne and Pilbara and all that, and every time you drive into a homestead, it's the same feeling of like, the oasis of trees, green lawn. It's usually in a really pretty spot by a river.
I love that driving into a homestead for you is this big coming home feeling, like warm and fuzzies, whereas for me, driving into a homestead is like the anxiety 101, because I'm like, which one is the homestead? Which one is the quarters? Where's the cookhouse? Like, am I going to the right place? Where should I park? Am I going to be parking in somebody's spot? Are they going to think I'm an idiot for parking here? Like, oh my God, like, that's my internal dialogue driving up a driveway.
All I worry about is the pet bull rubbing on my mirrors or something.
Yeah, whereas you've just got like, it's probably this nice music playing in the background, like, you're just coming home.
Oh yeah, pretty much. Oh, Christ, we had the life. We really had the life. I was a rat bag. I will admit right now, I was the biggest rat bag of a child. I would wander all the time. It was usually only between the chook house, the horse yards, and the workshop, and I'd go down and annoy the boys in the workshop, or I'd go steal molasses out of the horse shed, or, I don't know, annoy the chooks. But I was known to wander down to the creek a lot. And I knew I was in trouble when Dad had to come look for me on the motorbike. And I remember, I don't remember him finding me, but I remember hearing him and shitting myself. But yeah, we had a TV, but it didn't work. School of the air, I only did 1 year. So
was that over two way though? Or was that?
Yeah. That was the old, morning, Mrs. Smith, over. But it was all colouring in and crayons, so it wasn't, there were just beautiful memories.
So you have this pretty idyllic childhood growing up at Mount Clare Station, and then when you're 8 years old, the family sells up and decides to move from a station to a big farm
Yeah. So we didn't
go to the south.
We didn't sell until 2002.
Yep.
We did what everyone's doing now, and we bought a property just west of Carnarvon, and it decided to go into drought straight away. I don't think it rained for the 4 years that we were there, but that was definitely a huge step for my family. I mean, the station, we were having horrible bloody droughts. We couldn't seem to catch a break. So, yeah, Dad thought we'll buy a farm. At least we can take the weaners and the cows down there and give the property a break. As far as management went, I'd love to think that my dad was ahead of his time, but that was just his mindset. And so, yeah, we bought the farm, and he used to fly from Carnarvon to the station and back again in a day.
Just like a little fixed wing?
Yep. Yeah, we had a little Cessna 150, which had I'm not very good at my planes, but it was a 175 or a 185 engine. So, I mean, if anyone who's met my dad, he's about 6 foot tall and 3 foot wide. And and so, yeah, he reckons it was like flying a mini miner with a V8. He could take off on a clay pan, and it was his little pride and joy. But asking himself, and he absolutely hated flying. So, but he just had to do it. It just came with the job.
And then eventually you guys made the move permanently down to the farm?
Yeah, yep. So we sold the lot in 2002, and we bought two properties just east of Walkaway, which is Geraldton Midwest, and we've been there ever since.
And what was that like going from station life to farm life? Because, I mean, farms are still pretty – it's kind of still a pretty big playground for a kid.
Oh, yeah.
They're pretty different as well.
It took me 10 years to forgive my parents. I'm not going to lie. There were many tears. It took me a long time to call the place where we are now, Mount Michael. It took me a long time to call that home. And I think it wasn't until I started going away and working other places that, yeah, I was sort of a little bit more proud to call Mount Michael home.
It would have been pretty different because at the station you always had those people coming and going in a stock camp. Did you have other staff on the farm, or was it kind of just the family and maybe one or two?
Yeah, no, it was just the family for the first, 10 years. So, yeah, 8 years. And, yeah, we ran the two properties. So we had, one property's 1,400 hectares and the other's 1,800 hectares. So we ran the two together. God knows how many cattle we ran. Everyone called us absolute loonies. You know, we were the pastoralists that came to the Midwest, and apparently we didn't know how to grow grass. And we sure showed them, that's for sure. And, we took on a lot. And you'd think that coming from some place that it's 300,000 hectares to, you know, just under 3,000 hectares, you'd think that the workload would be a lot less, but it was not. We are intense, to say the least.
Yeah, a lot more intensive, I suppose. The station was extensive.
Yes.
Did you have to move to school in town then? Were you close enough to a town?
Yeah. So started day bugging, I guess you'd call it.
What on earth is day bugging?
So my mum always called it. I guess you had your boarders and your day bugs. And so I was a day bug.
I never heard of the term day schoolers, but okay, yeah, day bugs, cool.
I guess that's a Sydney term.
So would you just catch a bus?
Yeah.
How long was the bus ride to get to school?
Oh, God, it was like 10 or 15 minutes. It was great.
Oh, that's not bad at all. Basically a city kid.
Geraldton was a city. It had everything that we ever could have asked for. It had an ocean. I had seen an ocean before, but we weren't big swimmers or anything like that. Yeah, and going from... Like I said before, my sister was 10 years older than me. So
that'd have been a harder adjustment for her, do you think? Because she had so much more time on the station.
No, she was done and dusted.
Or was she like, yes, I'm like, because she would have been closer to 18 then, wouldn't she?
Oh, so she'd left school and she'd done a year working on the station with Dad.
Yeah.
And from memory, I think she'd actually gone to Queensland. Yeah, she might have to correct me if I'm wrong. But yeah, no, she wasn't home. So she'd well and truly flown the nest.
So you have your whole life picked up and moved, not to town because you're still on a farm,
but
a lot closer to town than you were. How did you cope with missing station life? Did you try and – I mean, it's hard when you're a kid. You don't really have the option to get in a car and drive and head out to a station. You're kind of reliant on your parents. So what did you do to try and cope?
I was outdoors a lot. I mean, go from one paradise to another, really. Property where our house is sounds so idyllic. It's not as pretty as it sounds, I promise, but it's nestled at the bottom of this big breakaway range. So pretty much right out my back door was this fantastic sort of hill, I guess, and it was full of wonderful new bugs and insects and trees and flowers. And I still remember the first time I saw an echidna and promptly tried to bring one home.
Oh, my God. I didn't know that. I've never seen one in the wild. I want one.
We get echidnas all the time. Echidnas, bobtails,
pythons. Yeah, everyone's seen a bobtail. No one cares.
Your bobtails up here are not what I thought were bobtails.
Wait, are yours bigger or smaller?
Ours are bigger and they actually have like a – it looks like someone's knocked off the end of their tail.
Oh, interesting.
Whereas yours have like a pointy tail. We saw one the first night we were here and I was not running around the hotel trying to find this lizard.
That's crazy. But like echidnas, I want an echidna. Did you try and pick one up?
They're really heavy. Just for the FYI, of all things, I had a broken wrist. I'd always had broken bones. And I remember wrapping, if you get them when they're trying to dig a little hole, just forget about it. You'll never move them because they managed to anchor themselves in the dirt.
Wow.
But this thing was crossing the road. And so I just picked it up with my cast and wrapped my jumper in between me and the echidna because they are really prickly. And I carried this thing probably a good like K and a half home, and then my mum made me let it go and I was devastated.
I would have been too. That's a lot of effort to put in. You're like, Mom, this is a pretty cheap pair. Like,
I know. And it was going to remulch your entire garden, but, it literally headed for the hills as soon as I let it go.
It was like, see you, bye.
Pretty much.
When was the next time you got to go back out onto a station?
Oh, all the time. We're regulars at the Landor races. Dad was involved in the committee. I've probably missed about 2 years in my entire life. Yeah, so got to go up all the time. Aunties and uncles. I still had a lot of family up in the Gascoyne, Meekatharra Shires, so was going up all the time to visit them. And I also had godparents south of Carnarvon on a sheep station. And I guess that's where my work ethic for the pastoral industry really got set hold because I'd go up there for school holidays and, help with shearing and, of course, as a kid, working with sheep is a lot different to working with cattle. In the cattle yards, as a kid, your parents are always worried about where you are and are you going to get run over or is something going to chase you up the rails? Whereas a sheep, they can sort of just let you go a bit more. So, I think my first shearing I did when I was about 14. And by the time I had my 17th. We always were shearing on my birthday, so every year I moved up the ranks a bit more, and by the time I was about 16 or 17, I was the boss's 2IC and helping him as far as making decisions. I wasn't in that, but I was definitely sort of running a crew of a couple of backpackers, and I loved it. And I think I stopped working there when they sold the property in about 2012, 13.
When did you finish school? Did you actually finish school?
So
through to year 12?
Yep. So I went to six different schools. Of course, Meekatharra School, Carnarvon, and then Warkway Primary. And then Mum wanted the best for me. So she sent me off to PLC.
Perth Ladies
Presbyterian Ladies College. Yes. The best Peppermint Grove, if you don't mind. and don't get me wrong, fantastic school, but adjusting from being this little free willy on a farm to being confined to a boarding house.
Oh, would you have had to wear those like hideous long skirts and like little hat?
We had the hats and the Panamas and berets, depending on summer and winter.
On beret.
Oh, yes. And we had to have it, to a certain angle to the left. And it was, rules and me didn't get along all that great, especially dress codes. I was always forgetting to put my ribbon in my hair so Mum got my uniform bill at the end of the year because every time you forgot to put your ribbon in, you could go to the service desk and buy a new ribbon. So I would buy about 3 ribbons a week because I kept forgetting to put them in my hair. My poor mum was getting the bill at the end of it all. But, the school undoubtedly was fantastic. And I remember, loving science, loving English is my favourite subject. I'm terribly dyslexic, and yet I loved it. I think it was the teachers were really raw, and they loved their job. So, of course, that was contagious. But my time there was limited. I only lasted 2 years, and the boarding just wasn't for me. So I came home, and I went to Geraldton Grammar for a year and a half, and that was opposite. The school did not suit me at all, and, yeah, I just didn't fit me. So I ended up finishing year 12 at Morrowag, and I walked out of there with a ducks and a heap of awards and a really bright outlook on life.
Wow, that's it's so good that it turned out that way, because it's hard enough going through those years as a teenager as it is, even if you're in the one high school, navigating that period of your life, but to have so much disruption and to be changing, because it's hard, yeah. You know, you go somewhere for a bit and you have to stick it out for a bit to go, is it me? Like, am I not giving this enough of a crack, or is this just not the right fit?
Mm.
And by the time you give it a good period of time, yeah. But then.
Yeah, no, and I, to this day, will be forever grateful that my parents, they really, you know, they understood. You know, Dad had been to boarding school. He started boarding school when he was about, oh my God, 9 or something, if that. Like, you know, all those boys got sent to school really, really young, because education just wasn't a thing out in the stations. It was hard work. So he didn't get it so much, but my sister had a rough time at school, and my mum had to watch her really, like, just go through 5 years. Or, you know, so it was only about 4 years in the end, and she had no options. You know, they were still living on the station, so there was no option of coming home. So my sister, unfortunately, yeah, she had to gruel it out, whereas mum sort of went for me, oh, bugger it. We've got the option of bringing her home. And it, to this day, I will forever be thanking my parents, because it was the best decision they ever made.
And so what happened when you left ag school? Where did you go next? With this great outlook on life.
Oh, yeah, home. Yeah, packed up the ute and the horse float and drove straight to back to Yennefarra, of all places.
That was
so that's when mum and dad first met.
Oh, yes. Okay. Mm. Yeah.
So, yeah, not that I had much to do growing up in Yennefarra, but I sort of went back to the home roots. And my best friend's family owned it at the time. And so I did a bit of work there. They were in a awful drought. And, yeah, it was a really rude awakening to what life was actually like on a pastoral station. You know, I had these nostalgic memories of, you know, good-looking 16-year-old men and, you know, horses galloping around and campfires, only to be met with, you know, dragging dead cows away from windmills and, you know, feeding out hay at mills and seeing carcasses. I'm not going to lie, it wasn't pretty. And so we went from Yennefarra. They also bought another property closer to Carnarvon, and we did a bit of goat mustering. That was a wake-up call. I'd done a little bit of goat mustering south of Carnarvon, but this was a whole new sort of adventure.
Talk us through mustering goats versus cattle and sheep.
If I knew what I was doing, it probably would have been a lot easier.
Is this true?
Yeah, you know, one of those things, I'd done one little McDonald working stock school and I thought I knew everything and, yeah, I had no freaking idea what I was doing. So, they're definitely different. Goats, if a goat doesn't want to walk, he will just lie down. And there is no kicking, screaming, thrashing, pulling you can do to convince him to move again. And they're really cheeky, and they will just whole mob will just blow, and they'll run in about 100 different directions. Whereas at least cows, you know, you've got your herd, and they'll stick together a little bit more. But nah, goats, there would be days when we would get up, we'd go out, we'd start mustering at 5:30, and we'd get a mob together, and then by 2 o'clock in the afternoon, we'd have nothing.
You have just single-handedly convinced me to never go goat mustering in my life, unless there's like 12 helicopters and like 14 dogs.
Yeah, well, it was all
and a moving a Hessian wing around them.
We needed that was sand dune and clay pan country, and I just am so glad I was on a horse, not a bike, because yeah, at least horses don't get bogged. That's all I can think of.
Oh, and then where did you head? So you're working on friends' places for a little bit.
Yeah.
And then when did you branch out to go to your first property that wasn't kind of connected to your family or friends?
So I came home from goat mustering probably about, my parents went over east for a holiday in March. And so I came home to look after the property. And in that time, I scored myself a job on Yanri. And yeah, sort of the plan was to drive straight up to Yanri as soon as mum and dad got home. But plans changed. Unfortunately, lost a really good mate in a car accident, which it rocked me, I think, because it was, my family's pretty well known to grief. And so it was sort of pretty hard though for the first time to lose someone who was actually really close to me. I said I was 18, thought I had, you know, the best horizons ahead, and I just remember driving up to Yanri thinking, like, what am I doing? and actually driving into the Yanri homestead was probably the first time I drove into a homestead and didn't feel that, you know, fantastic feeling, because I think I still had so much baggage at home. But in saying that, got up there, jumped into the stock camp, and yeah, we did a couple of months mustering around Yanri, Kadari. We went out to Sheila. Yeah, did all sorts of things. I definitely learnt that I had no idea how to, you know, work a mob properly. It was, I sometimes wonder if I missed out on learning a lot of things because we moved off the station. So, you know, on a farm, we don't really work big mobs of cattle the way you would on a station. And we definitely didn't handle wild cattle. So it was a huge learning curve.
Would you say it was the first time, I suppose, though, that you weren't in a somewhat sheltered environment because you didn't know them? Whereas when you're on your family place, like, it's family, and then the other people you knew the family.
Yeah. I mean, it was definitely the De Pledges and the Baines have a very long family history. And so it wasn't so much that I wasn't surrounded by friends and family. It was just that all of a sudden a job was expected of me. And yeah, I really had to sort of pull my boots on and go, you know, put my big girl panties on and go to work. And yeah, it wasn't what I was expecting. And it was, yeah, like I said, it was a really big learning curve, so much so that I probably didn't deal with it as well as I could have. And I asked to be moved from the stock camp to the cookhouse, and I became the station cook.
But that would have, you know, it's a huge year for you, though. It's your first time kind of going out solo or independent, even though you said you guys had a family history. But the first time where you've kind of been like, you know, a guest or a friend or, you know, just an extended part of the family, whereas you're now a real full-blown employee.
While I was on the books.
And then you were so young and you're in your teenage years, which I think for anyone is, you know, just a journey in itself.
Yes.
And then you're dealing with the grief of, or like the first real loss or big loss in your life. So that's a lot to, I think a lot of people can find it hard to adjust to their first station job, full stop.
without throwing in the glitter.
Yeah, without throwing in all the extra stuff that you had with you. Now, was that when Mama and Papa Bear De Pledge still lived there?
No. So they had moved down to the farm, and they were based down there, but they were still well and truly involved in everything. And yeah, so there was a lot going on. And yeah, both Joe and Jane were, well, and I'm so glad that I got to spend, you know, that time with them, because they are, oh, that whole family, they're just bloody awesome.
So many people listening, I suppose, who aren't from the Pilbara or WA in some way, shape or form may not know the De Pledges, but they are basically the greatest family of time.
Yes.
So there's, there's Mama and Papa Bear De Pledge, then they had three kids, but then, you know, then they're married and got their families that way as well. And oh my God, like there's no words, like you can't.
Yeah, no, they're
absolute legends,
awesome.
And just amazing people. Yeah. And I've got to stop myself, otherwise I'm going to go on a tangent for the next 10 minutes about how.
Oh, yeah, no, join the club. No, they were fantastic. And especially, like I said, you know, I was finding it quite hard in the stock camp. And they, instead of telling me to just, you know, get on with it or get over it, you know, they really did go out of their way to make not a new job for me, but the cook happened to be leaving and they needed a new one. And yeah, it was easier to replace a delivery than it was a cook. So, yeah, I ended up in the kitchen, and I think I really enjoyed cooking, actually.
Could you cook? Because, like,
no.
I could not have cooked at that age.
Nope. I'm pretty sure that a pledge's phone bill went up a lot because I spent a lot of time on the phone to my mum saying, how do you cook a roast? How do you make mashed potatoes? How do you boil eggs? Like, how long do you boil these things for? How do you know when they cook without cracking half of the damn things open? So, I mean, I learned a lot in the way. And it's just simple life skills of learning how to cook a meal. I mean, I could cook. I could cook steak and I could bake bread and all that sort of stuff, but I couldn't put a meal together. And my mum was a fantastic cook. Like, as a kid, she would feed 10 blokes and just, you know, whisp all this food on the table and it would just be amazing. And then there'd be dessert and, you know, and she was like a duck on water. And here I was, you know, my hair was a mess. There was flour all over my shirt. There was gravy on the roof. And I somehow used to put, you know, oh God, a couple of veggies and a bit of meat, potatoes. That was Cobb's favorite saying. Just meat, potatoes, Pippi, just meat, potatoes.
I can hear him saying that, especially when you just said Pippi, like just before it's giving you a nickname and just being like.
Oh, yeah, we all had our nicknames and I won't go repeating mine on air.
Oh, and so how long were you at Yannery for and at what point did you change from stock camp to cook?
Oh, Jesus, that was 10 years ago, Steph.
Unlike most of the recent people I've interviewed, you are not heavily pregnant and you cannot blame this on baby brain. So why don't you have a great memory from 10 years ago?
God, you know I'm blonde, right?
I'm just wondering, did you spend more time in the cookhouse or the stock camp?
I want to say it's pretty half and half.
Yeah, okay.
Memory. And even then, when I was cooking, I would still go help in the yards and then rush back and cook breakfast for the truckies or like, and actually it was fantastic. Anyone who wants to go work on a station but doesn't want to go, you know, get into the nitty gritty of mustering, go be a station cook. It is honestly the gateway to heaven. You're your own boss. You end up in a room full of food. There's always chocolate. and you can, when you're not busy, you just sneak down to the cattle yards and you can sit on the top rail and watch, or you can get involved. There is just this, it's just a horizon of opportunity.
The most euphemistic description of a station cook I've ever heard in my life.
Oh, but it's true. I think it's a job is, you know, a job like being a station cook, there are no boundaries. As long as you put food on the table and keep the kitchen clean, and if you got to look after the garden like I did as well, as long as you keep everything alive,
yeah,
the potty calves, the workers, the garden, you'll do fine. And what you do in your spare time is up to you. And so I think, whereas when you're in the stock camp, you wake up at 5:30 and you have breakfast and you go do this and you've always got something to, you know, that's really
not as much free time.
No, not at all. And you really do, like, I'm not saying that station cooks don't have a job to do, but like
the structure's a little different.
It is a lot different. And I'd get back to being a station cook any day, except for the fact that I'm allergic to food because it makes my ass swell.
Oh my God, I didn't realize that was an allergy. I think I suffer from that too. How do we get tested? Aside from looking in the mirror. How did you find it? What I want to know and pick your brains about is you were struggling a bit in the stock camp, and this is the point where most people would cut and run, or I've got so many stories of people I know who have just like left in the middle of the night,
mm-hmm.
In all sorts of different jobs on stations, or, you know, just left on bad terms, or just, you know, kind of held it all in until it kind of explodes. But you managed to stick out the rest of the season just in a different role and kind of keep face and stay there. How do you do that? Because I feel so many of us would be like, well, no, if I didn't, now I'm using the big air quotes here, succeed at the stock camp job, like, well, I just can't be here. But you completely blew that idea out of the water.
A mix between ignorance and stubbornness, I think. Maybe they're the same thing. I don't know. But I guess I didn't know how to quit. And I definitely wanted to quit. Do not get me wrong. There were days I'm pretty sure I went to Joe and said, that's it. I've had enough. I want to go home. And he said, went, oh, you know, Pip, you know, it's going to be okay. Like, you know, you're just having a bad day. And it definitely taught me a lot in the way that, you know, we do have bad days and sometimes you got to mark them on the calendar, but don't forget to count your good days. Like, you know, bad days always seem worse at the time, but it's just because that's the moment that you're in. Whereas when you're having a good day, well, you don't think about it as much.
Yeah.
And so it's, yeah, it's that, like I said, I was given the option to quit, but it just wasn't an option. Yeah. So I just kept on trudging on. I mean, there was definitely good days and bad days. And it wasn't necessarily because of the crew or anything like that. I mean, God, I was probably dealing with unknown mental health problems at the time that I had no idea about. But yeah, that was just what you did.
Imagine the job of, you know, Joe and Jane and or any station manager anywhere. I mean, people not just back then but today, not only are you employer to and leader and boss to all your staff, but when you have such a lot of people will have at least a few young people in their crew, you're kind of like a pseudo parent as well.
Oh, and they nailed it. They were the best surrogate parents that, you know, you could ever ask for.
I just want to adopt them so bad. I might have told them that as well. And they're like, okay, strange lady, please, like, keep your distance.
No, I mean, yeah, the whole family. And, you know, it's funny. I used to spend a lot of time on the phone to Paul. And it's funny because I'd met Paul, but I don't remember it. I must have been drunk. I don't know. at the age of 16, God knows. But so I spent a lot of time on the phone to Paul, and before I knew it, getting a phone call from Paul, even though it was for her to go to speak to Janie, it was really nice. And they did really become a really close family. And I was lucky enough to see Paul really recently on really good conditions. And I said, oh my God, you know, Paul, we used to spend so much time on the phone and, you know, and yet I've never met you properly. And she's like, well, you know, yeah, we did meet. And I'm like, well, I don't remember it. She's like, well, I do. I'm
like, oh, okay. She's like, look at me with my memory beating the young person.
Woman's had three kids and has a memory like an elephant. But yeah, it was, yeah. And like I said, I think it really does it. It separates the good from the bad managers in the way that, you know, a manager that can really treat young kids in their crew, there's a fine line between treating them like family and spoiling them and treating them like family and giving a bit of tough love. And I think knowing that line and knowing, you know, when to give them a pat on the back and tell them they've done a good job, and knowing when to say, righto, mate, come on, toughen up. It's just a bruise.
Like, and I mean, that's the thing, though. Like, you can go to ag school and, you know, get your certificates and your diplomas in ag. You can go to a stock handling school or a working dog school. You can go to a land management school or, you know, read up on this stuff.
Oh, you can have a uni degree.
When do you go to school to learn how to deal with other people? Like, looking after cattle and country is one thing, but being like, it's not just that. You've got to be a people person. Yeah. Like, you've got to be able to work people as well as cattle. And
yeah. No, and I remember they used to send us away on what do you call it, work experience.
Yeah.
Biggest waste of time. I honestly didn't even do work experience because I remember a dad saying, I'm pretty sure it was in November. So everyone had pretty much finished mustering. And I remember, I think I wanted to go back up to Carnarvon and do work experience on the family friend's property. And the school said, oh, it's too far away. We won't go up there and check on you. And I was like, oh, I'll give you a ring or something, you know, when I finish work. Anyway, dad said, nah, listen, there's no point doing work experience if they're not going to go let you actually go and experience what you want to go do. So yeah, nothing can prepare you. I don't think, well, from my point of view, nothing can prepare me for what I was about to walk into. But looking back, it was the best thing I ever did.
And you stuck out the whole year and finished the season.
Almost.
And you stuck out the whole year and finished the season.
Almost. So I was going to finish a little bit early. we had Landor coming up. And like I said before, Landor was like the highlight of my life. And so I was going to knock off and go to Landor, and I was going to go home from Landor. There was only a couple of weeks left of mustering. And then I guess I'll start from the beginning. So I was cooking dinner one night and noticed it was pretty quiet. The boys hadn't come in for their beers and nibbles and dip. And Cobb came into the kitchen and told me they needed to sit down. And my heart was going 100 miles out. I actually thought he was going to sack me. And like, and then he had this look on his face, and I'll never forget it. It was the look of anguish. And I knew something really bad had happened. And my first thought went to the kids. I thought something happened to the kids. And he set me down and he said that, my mum had died. So, as an 18-year-old, just struggled with, I say 6 to 7 months, 700 kilometres away from home, to be sat down and told that was a huge kick to the guts, to say the least. I could not commend that family any more for the way that they handled that situation. I was given all the privacy, all the support. I didn't have to think about anything. They did everything humanly possible to make that situation as comfortable as possible for me. So I remember crying a lot, obviously. And it wasn't really until about, I want to say maybe 4 hours later, that I realised that my mum had committed suicide. So it was really hard for me. And it's funny because I'd rung her that day because I was cooking a roast. And, that's right, I ran out of gas. The gas bottle ran out halfway through cooking this roast, and I've rung mum because I couldn't undo the bloody screw because Blondie here didn't realise that gas bottles are left-hand thread. So I'm battling it anyway. So mum's quickly righted me on that, and we had this really funky little it was really a happy conversation for someone who was going through what she was going through at the time. And I remember she giggled at, we were giggling about, me, looking after all these blokes. And I think she was probably getting a bit nostalgic in the way that that's how she started. She started as a station cook, and all the kids would find the coop, and here I was battling it out in a hot, sweaty little kitchen. And I was, I guess in a way, she was proud of me because I'd done it. I'd wanted to quit so many times. And she said, no, you can do this. And I did it. I was about 5 days from packing my swag and driving out. And got to go home 4 days early. So that wasn't easy. And it was definitely changed the relationship between, it strengthened the relationship, I want to say, between definitely Cobb and I. We'd gone from being very much, he was the boss and I was just some young ditzy jillaroo, to going from, he was my mate and I'd like to consider myself one of his mates. And we really built, it's funny because I didn't see him again for another about 4 years. And it was, I remember driving into the homestead and getting that warm, fuzzy feeling of coming home. So that was, that was nice.
When you said it was about 4 hours before you realised how your mum had passed, is that because they waited to tell you, or you just weren't processing at that point in time?
I had no idea my mum suffered from depression. Mum had not had an easy life. She nursed her dad until he passed away from cancer when she was 18, quit nursing school, moved across the country to marry some good-looking, tall, blonde fella and start a family on a property nowhere near a city. I mean, my mum was a city girl. She was as city as they come. So she had a lot of struggles to deal with. And then to top that off, in in 88, Mum was involved in a car accident. It was two people lost their lives, and one of those people was her son, and he was 3 years old. So dealing with not just, I guess, that sense of isolation, and she had to just completely readjust her whole life for love, because we do these things. You know, she now has to deal with losing her son, being charged by the courts for the death of her son. I mean, you can just imagine, you know, it's bad enough losing a child, let alone being blamed in front of everyone for that. From then on, there was quite a few deaths in the family. From, you know, we lost Dad's brother, and then Dad's best mate. And I'm from memory, they all went within about 5 years of each other. So they say things happen in threes. But, you know, Mum, I don't know, once again, you just got up and you got on.
I suppose that's how it was, though, in those days, which thankfully isn't now. But when we were preparing for this episode and you had told me about this, you mentioned that she would have to drive down that same road where the accident happened.
Yeah. Every time she went to town, which was about, sometimes once a month when the roads were open. No, every time she had to drive past the same spot, which just, and it's funny, I didn't get shown the spot till I was about 15, 16. And it's funny because sometimes I'll drive down that road, which I do, I drive down that road a lot, and I won't even notice it. I'll realise I'm past it, you know, kilometres away. And sometimes I'll drive past and my heart would be in my mouth. And there's, you know, they say that, you know, spirits and all that sort of stuff aren't real, but I kid you not, I've driven past there on sunset. I don't know when the accident happened, but I remember one night I drove past there on sunset and there was a light coming over the hill, but there was no car. So, and the sun was going from the other way. So I don't know, maybe there was a windscreen in the scrub or something, but just having to deal with all that, countless droughts, you know, dealing with a family that's not your own. I mean, you know, we were a family business. So she had to deal with my grandfather who, as much as he was an exceptional person, fathers-in-laws, you know, sometimes don't, you know, they can make things difficult and easy. But, yeah, so there was a lot to deal with, but I think her main goal was to watch her kids grow up, which she did. And she, you know, I think it was funny that day on the phone, you know, she was like, oh, you know, you're all grown up now. You know, you've done it. And I think she'd had enough and it was her time to go. And people can call it selfish. They can call it what they like. But I think when you've dealt with what she dealt with for 30 years, and God knows what before that, I reckon it was the most selfless thing that anyone could ever do. She gave us all the tools that we would ever need. You know, my sister's now a mum. You know, she really did. She gave us, I said, the tools to carry on with life. And I think be the best person that you can. Just be kind to others was always one thing. She always used to say to me, if you can't say anything nice, don't say it at all. And there's definitely times when I probably didn't listen to her as much as I should have. But, yeah, and just be whoever the hell you want to be. Don't worry about what other people want from you. As long as us kids were happy, you know, like I said, she pulled me out of two schools, you know, just to make me happy. So all she ever wanted was our happiness. And she always put her family's happiness before her own. We will never know the struggles that she dealt with. She was seeing doctors. She was on medication. She was seeing psychiatrists, psychiatric therapists, counsellors, and she did have fantastic friends that she talked to. But we will never know the extent of her demons. And I think, you know, since losing her, I guess that's become one of my real, I'm not going to say it's not a passion. It's not something that I wake up every morning I want to advocate mental health, but it is definitely something that I really do believe in is that if you have something on your mind or if you are having a bad day, you know, pick up the phone and tell someone, you know, whether it's a friend or, you know, a family. I have a dog and that dog probably thinks that I am clinically, you know, unwell because of the, you know, I think getting stuff off your chest, seeing a medical practitioner, psychiatrist, and just having a good old chat to someone can really make you feel a lot better about yourself. It can clear a lot of things up. Things always sound different when you say them out loud. I mean, I'm going to listen back to this podcast and, yeah, think very differently of it. But, yeah, when you – mental health shouldn't be something to be ashamed of.
I suppose the thing is I feel like mental health and mental illness get mixed up a lot, whereas mental health is something everybody has, just like we have our physical health.
Yes, yes,
and it's something that has to be maintained, like our physical health, whereas mental illness is something different altogether.
Yeah.
That's when there is an illness.
Yeah.
So everybody has mental health and we all have to take steps, you know, just like we go for a run or we play sports or we eat our vegetables to maintain our physical health.
Yes.
You have to do certain things to maintain your mental health. But while you're at school and you are put into phys ed class or home ec and you learn all those other things, how to look after your
health is not something we're taught at school. No.
No, and never spoken about. And it just makes me, I don't know the word, it just makes me sad that your mum, you know, what do you say? It was at least, you know, over 20 years since her son passed away. And the just, I know the lack of support there would have been around back then, especially out in the station.
Yeah.
Like if and when she could have found someone to talk to. And like you said, it was that real, you just got on with it. You just moved on attitude.
Yeah.
And that's just not how the mind works.
No. And like, I mean, and let's be blunt, you know, we definitely were not the only family out in the Gascoyne to lose a child. A lot of kids my age have buried a sibling. It was not uncommon at all. And I think for mum, coming from the background of which she did, you know, she was one of five. Their futures were set out for them. Her father was a doctor, her brother was a lawyer, and all three sisters, and including and herself, were all nurses. There was no question about it. You were to leave school and become a nurse. And so for mum to sort of turn around and say, well, I don't want to be a nurse anymore, yeah, there was no support for, you know, yeah, the family didn't know how to deal with that, I guess, in a way, and letting her go was their way of dealing with it. And it was the best thing they ever did because otherwise I wouldn't be here. But, yeah, there was, and like I said before, getting right back to my great-grandfather, you just got on with things. You know, he came back from World War and, you know, gosh knows what he'd seen over there. And yet he built a, you know, sustainable, profitable business off it. And it was, you either got it or you don't. I think when it comes to mental illness, some of us have the tools to deal with it built into us and some of us don't. And, you know, especially for me in the past 12 months, I thought I had all the tools until I had a pretty big breakdown and went to a practitioner and, yeah, I was diagnosed with – I was only diagnosed with mild depression and anxiety. But it felt weird to all of a sudden be stamped with a mental illness.
With the label.
Yes. It was not something that I'm proud of. But at the same time, it made me get off my ass and go talk to someone who could help me deal – and give me the tools to move on and move forward and, you know, just little things like writing in a diary every day.
I think it's important. I just want to quickly pull you up on when you said it's something I'm not proud of. I really want to get the point across that it's not something to be ashamed of either.
No, though. Definitely not. When I say it's not something I'm proud of in the way that
That you should be proud that, you've gone out
on it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the thing, I guess, with being stamped with that label is that it presents the symptoms manifest differently in everyone. How person A has depression and how person B has depression may be completely different. It isn't not like, oh, I have a cough and you just have a cough, or, you know, it's not like I have a fever and, you know, you could just measure the fever at this temperature and that's what it is. And everyone who gets this has this kind of fever or diabetes or whatever, and we all present the same way. Mental illness presents differently on such a spectrum in different people.
Yes,
so
yeah.
The fact that you kind of cottoned on, and when you say some of us have it built into us and some of us don't, I think a lot of that has to do though with your upbringing and what you're exposed to growing up, because if you're in an environment that never talks about this and you just don't know about it, then how would you have these skills? Or if you're in a very different home that has, you know, a lot of discussions about this, or if it was taught in school, then you're kind of obviously set up to have those tools in your toolbox. So even if you don't have those tools with you right now, you can always gain them.
Oh, and they're out there. We are in a, there is so much support out there at the moment for this sort of thing. It's so nice to think that, you know, our generation, like our children, are going to get brought up in a world where mental, you know, mental issues or depression, anxiety, all this, it's not going to be something that's hush-hush anymore. Anyone can talk about anything from your sexuality to, you know, if you're having a bad day, you know, it's there's nothing to be worried about anymore, because the only way I can think about it is we're not racist to these things anymore. You know, it used to be you didn't talk about mental health because, you know, it was wrong. You just didn't. Whereas now I'll sit down with a couple of friends and we'll sit there and we'll talk about our mental health and we'll talk about the shit days and we'll talk about the good days and we'll have a little nibbles and dribbles on how we're feeling. And it is really comforting to know that myself, my sister, our children will never have to deal with what my mum did, because I honestly reckon some days she was hell on earth. And yeah, so as far as, you know, if you're having a bad day, don't feel ashamed about it. You know, and if you're having more than one bad day in a row, go see a professional. There's no shame in it. They are fantastic people. The good ones have, you know, food on the table that you can eat while you're talking to them, or they'll offer you a cup of tea. It's not scary. It's not something to be ashamed of at all. And I think it took me 10 years to realize that I wasn't working at my highest potential, I guess, my highest happiness. But I look back now and it was, yeah, the last 6 months have been a real turning curve.
I think it's incredible that, you know, after everything you've been through, things could have gone, it's not necessarily one way or the other, but there's so many different paths you could have gone down and that this is where you've ended up. And I know we're going to do another 2 episodes with you because...
Lucky listeners. Get more of this voice.
Yeah, well, this has only taken us up to 2010 and we've got the last 10 years to fill in. And
goodness,
looking at my notes, we have got some adventures to cover. But I just think, you know, how you've coped with what's happened has obviously impacted how the next 10 years or the last 10 years have unfolded and played out in your life, because they all could have been very different given the circumstances. So your attitude is... It's hard. I was going to say commendable, but then I feel like a school principal at like a, what are the assembly, but it's just encouraging. I don't know. I'm not even going to try and put a label on it, because I think people get the gist of what we're trying to say, is that your attitude and the way you've taken this in your stride, and you can admit that it's not all just, you know, pick up and keep going. You have those stumbles, but you've asked for help and you've worked your way through it and you've acknowledged it's taken, you know, 10 years to kind of,
yeah, you know, work my way through it. Yeah. I mean, and I'm not even 30 yet. So it's never too late. It's, I guess another thing I could really say is it's never too late, but it's also never too early. You know, if you don't put it off, I put it off for 10 years, and as much as the last 10 years have been a huge adventure for me, I can't wait for the next 10 years. So if you need a chat, pick up the phone, go around to your mates, and, just have a chat.